The NASDAQ Composite set another record today, even though it only eked out about a 2-point gain. Its run-up over the past 6 months has been nothing short of phenomenal. The technology-heavy index is up 100% from last August. But while the technology sector soars, much of the rest of the stock market is losing ground. The ongoing rise in tech stocks has occurred despite a series of interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve, and that illustrates the difficulty the Federal Reserve officials face as they confront what's often called the new economy. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
In recent years, Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan has repeatedly warned that the economy may be growing too fast for its own good. The single biggest reason for this is the huge rise in consumer spending. Many Americans are spending more money than they make, saving little and borrowing heavily. And one reason they're willing to do that, Greenspan has suggested, is that they've made so much money in the stock market that they feel wealthy. Sun Won Son is chief economist at Wells Fargo Bank.
The stock market really is the canary in the coal mine for Chairman Greenspan. Without a meaningful, sustained correction in the stock market, we really cannot expect an economic slowdown that we are looking for.
Although Greenspan has never said he is specifically targeting the stock market, he's made clear he thinks a correction would be a healthy development. But there's a problem for Fed officials. Greenspan can try to slow down the market by raising interest rates, but the very stocks that are performing the best right now have proven to be the least sensitive to rate increases. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, says investors who are pouring their money into hot growth stocks like Qualcomm and Cisco, hoping to make a killing, won't be deterred by further interest rate increases.
Raising interest rates is just not going to have any impact on the expectation of huge profits that might eventually come out of the internet. What interest rate would cause you to revise your expectations about AOL or Yahoo? I cannot see that the interest rate is going to have any impact there.
And in fact, interest rate increases can actually benefit tech stocks. Joseph Lero, chief economist at Stone and McCarthy, says higher interest rates tend to hurt certain sectors of the economy, such as the automobile industry, the most. As those stocks fall, Lero says, investors transfer their money into more promising sectors, such as technology.
So on a relative basis, the gap between the growth rates in technology and let's say consumer cyclicals actually widens, and it actually makes the tech sector look a little bit more attractive.
That's what appears to be happening right now. Big blue chip companies that remain highly profitable, such as McDonald's, have seen their share prices plummet, while many technology stocks keep climbing. This has led to an unusual and even historic divergence in the market. Lero says that of the 7,000 biggest stocks traded today, only about 1,000 are doing especially well, but these are driving the NASDAQ index to record highs. Lero says there may ultimately be little the Federal Reserve can do to stop the tech stock boom. He says the only weapon at the Fed's disposal is higher interest rates, and that's not enough.
There is a level of interest rates that are so draconianly high that it'll squeeze the 65% of the economy. The demand will fall so sharply in that sector of the economy that you will see a drop-off in orders even for technology and communication equipment. And I don't think the Fed wants to do that. It can't push it. It cannot push the tightening that far, particularly when there's no discernible increase in the inflation rate outside of the energy sector in the U.S. economy.
The boom in tech stocks reflects profound changes in investor psychology. Once prudent investors believed in looking for fairly priced stocks that would pay dividends and hold their value over the years. But today many are looking for growth stocks that will make them rich. And such investors are proving to be unfazed by the kind of incremental interest rate increases the Fed can impose. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Secretary of Defense William Cohen is in Hong Kong today. It's the first stop of a four-nation Asian tour that will take him to Vietnam next week. Cohen will be the first U.S. Defense Secretary to visit Vietnam since the war ended there in 1975, an anniversary that the Vietnamese are currently celebrating. Aside from the obvious symbolism of the trip, Cohen is trying to begin a new relationship between the militaries of the two nations. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Senior Pentagon officials say Secretary of Defense Cohen has been planning a trip to Vietnam since the first weeks of his tenure at the Pentagon. Cohen has said he has limited goals for the trip and that he is not trying to rush the process of building military-to-military ties. The evolving relationship between Washington and Hanoi is complex, especially when viewed in the context of the emergence of China as Asia's preeminent power. The United States is uneasy about China's rise and has been cultivating ties with the 10 members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations as a sort of balance. Vietnam borders on China. It fought a three-week war in 1979 along that border, in which China lost more soldiers than the number of Americans who died in the Vietnam War. James Clad, a Georgetown University professor of Asian studies, says Vietnam is looking over its shoulder at China as Cohen prepares to arrive in Hanoi on Monday.
So the Vietnamese are very, very careful not to offend their neighbor, but in many important ways, the Vietnamese seek leverage. One of the things they did was join this ASEAN grouping back in 1995. Another way, very carefully, very cautiously, is to resume relations with the United States.
Trade is the basis for the improvement of bilateral relations between the U.S. and Vietnam. And although Vietnam initialed a trade pact last year, its leadership has been reluctant to implement it, which would require economic reforms that at this stage are hard for Hanoi to swallow. Without progress on trade, military ties will remain embryonic. Cohen is expected to visit the site of a downed U.S. fighter near Hanoi to encourage further progress in locating all the remains of missing American soldiers and airmen, and he will visit Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon, on Tuesday. But regional issues appear to be paramount on both sides. Robert Manning of the Council on Foreign Relations says that the leadership in Hanoi, like its counterparts elsewhere in Asia, is worried about worsening relations between Beijing and Washington.
The worst nightmare of Vietnam and every other Asian country is being forced to choose between the United States and China. Because they live there, and they're nervous about China, but they, you know, if you have a conflict over Taiwan, for example, which way is Japan going to go? It creates the potential for political polarization in the region and a new range of instabilities.
Some experts say Hanoi may want to play the role of bridge between the U.S. and China, seeking to find ways it can help improve relations between the two rival powers. In Hong Kong today and over the weekend, Cohen will discuss current tensions over Taiwan. He will also make stops in Japan and South Korea. Mike Schuster, NPR News, New York.
There are more questions this week about the future of democracy in Haiti. Parliamentary elections planned for later this month have been rescheduled for the third time in 4 months. The vote is now set for next month, but Haiti's President René Préval has denounced the new election plan. This is just the latest in a series of squabbles between the president and the legislature that has left Haiti's government virtually paralyzed for nearly 3 years. As NPR's Tom Gelton reports, foreign aid for Haiti is drying up as the United States and other countries grow impatient with the political stalemate.
The United States got involved in Haiti back in 1994 with one major aim, to bring democracy to the island. The U.S. effort to end military rule there and put the elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, back in office was called Operation Restore Democracy. After Aristide was installed, it became Operation Uphold Democracy. But 3 years ago, parliamentary elections were canceled after the first round, and new elections have not been held since then. George Fariol of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says he's found during several visits to Haiti what he calls a strange attitude there toward elections in general.
A certain ambivalence on a part of political leadership, those in government, regarding the electoral process, sort of standoffish, reserved, not expressing, if you will, a lot of enthusiasm, playing sort of backroom politicking.
The U.S. military mission in Haiti ended in January, having cost more than $2 billion. Another $500 million in economic aid is available for Haiti, but it's been put on hold because the Haitian government has so far not managed to enact a package of required economic reforms, in part because President René Préval dissolved the parliament a year ago. Haiti is one of the world's poorest countries, and yet, says George Fariol, it's a country whose proximity to the United States gave it a golden opportunity.
Unlike most other countries in the world, Haiti has, in fact, ironically, been provided with an unusual set of circumstances of goodwill from the United States, from the international community, and that goodwill has been, in many ways, wasted.
Republican leaders on Capitol Hill are now opposed to new spending there. Republican Congressman Porter Goss of Florida says the administration's Haiti policy is, in his words, a failure.
We should not turn our back on Haiti at all, but I think it's equally unwise to declare victory in Haiti and put on our rose-colored glasses and say all we have to do is keep sending money and pretending to have elections down there and labeling it a democracy when it's not. There is no judicial system there that works. There's no law and order that works. There's no parliament that meets and works. It's a dictatorship. We should call it a dictatorship and deal with it on that basis.
With U.S. assistance now sharply reduced, the international leadership for helping Haiti has passed increasingly to Canada, which has directed United Nations assistance to the country. The current U.N. mission aimed at strengthening the police force there will end next week, but Canada pushed for a new U.N. mission aimed again at strengthening democratic institutions in the country. David Lee is Canada's Haiti coordinator.
We're helping not because everything is perfect. If everything were perfect, international help would not be required.
The one point on which all sides agree is that Haiti needs help. Unemployment is more than 50%. Drug trafficking and other crimes are on the increase. George Farriol says the Haitian people should not be made to suffer for the failings of their leaders. The challenge for the international community, he says, is to nurture new leadership by strengthening local institutions and putting more pressure on those now running the government.
It's in that sense that I think the international community does have a continuing role to play. It may have to be more selective. The international community may have to be more demanding, frankly. But total disengagement, I think, is not an option.
Much will depend on whether the parliamentary elections come off next month as scheduled. International observers there say the conditions are technically ready, but a U.S. official who's monitoring the developments in Haiti says yesterday's criticism of the election plan by President René Préval is bad news. The odds the elections will actually occur next month, this official says, are diminishing. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.